You're now listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.
Hello, Colorado. This is the Engage the Rockies podcast. I am your host, Jarvis Caldwell, Executive Director of Engage the Rockies. Today, we have a special episode for you about a House bill that just dropped on Wednesday, March 6th. Today, we're recording this on Friday, March 8th. And this is this generated a lot of attention, and so we wanted to make sure that we jumped on this issue and we covered it as soon as possible. So this bill that we're going to cover today is House Bill 24-1363, named the Charter Schools Accountability. This is brought to us by Representatives Tammy Story and Lorena Garcia from the House of Representatives, and it is also sponsored by Senator Lisa Cutter from the state Senate. And today's guest that we have to talk about this bill is Ross Izzard. Now, when I saw this bill, I'd heard about it a little bit ahead of time before it actually dropped. And you know, I've heard of a lot of opinions in the education and the school choice community about what this bill was going to look like. And then when I saw it, let's just say I was a little surprised. This is a 55-page bill. If you know anything about the state legislature, a 55-page bill is pretty gigantic. I mean, that means that there are very drastic changes coming when you have a bill that long, and probably only a handful of bills throughout the whole session are actually that massive. And so there was one person I thought of who could talk about this better than anybody else in the state of Colorado, and that was Ross. And so Ross is the founder and principal of Zephos Strategies, LLC, a turnkey government affairs firm that helps clients across the nation build and deploy the systems, infrastructure, and knowledge needed to engage effectively with American government. Ross is the current senior fellow at the Independence Institute's Education Policy Center and former national policy director at ACE Scholarships. Ross also currently manages public policy for Education Alliance of Colorado, also known as EAC. Ross, thank you so much for joining us on short notice. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's jump right into it. We have a lot to cover. Like I said, this is a 55-page bill, and it took me quite a while to get through it and get out some of the key takeaways here. So let's start big picture. School accountability. So the bill, like I said, is called Charter Schools Accountability. Now, when I hear accountability, I think, okay, accountability is a good thing, but it's also implying that maybe there's not already accountability in the charter school system. So right now, from your expertise in this field, you know, are charter schools held accountable by local and state rules and laws as it is?
Yeah, so I think, you know, fundamentally, one of the big challenges for charter schools in Colorado is the fact that a lot of people don't really know and can't articulate what a charter school is, right? So There's kind of this assumption that they are sometimes a private school or maybe some sort of weird pseudo-private thing that exists outside the public system, and therefore they can just do whatever they want, sort of largely exempt from any sort of oversight by the government or anyone else. And it's flatly not true. So charters are public schools in Colorado. They are just as public as any neighborhood school that you would pick, just as public as any district-run traditional public school anywhere in any of Colorado's many hundreds of school districts, and therefore subject to all the same stuff. So they're held accountable for their academic results. They're held accountable for complying with the anti-discrimination statute and all of the various requirements that are attached to public schools. Held accountable for the personnel policies and obviously subject to state funding. And then beyond that, they have even more accountability, I would say, than your typical school, because charters have to go and seek authorization from one of two places. They can either seek it from their local school board and their local school district, who has to say yay or nay both to opening the charter school in the first place and to renewing it later on down the line when the contract expires, which is usually anywhere from every 2 to 5 years, depending on the school. Or to the State Charter School Institute, where I sit on the board, and they have to go back again, you know, to get open in the first place and again to be renewed. And those renewal discussions and opening discussions very often include really detailed analysis of their operational security and how they're doing there in terms of how their board is structured, how their governance is structured, how their staff works. their finances, so how they're using public money and taxpayer money, and then obviously their academic program, which curricula are they using, how are kids performing, how are they performing on state tests, how are they rated, since all of these schools are rated by the state board the same way as every other public school in the state. So the idea that this bill would be couched under the term of charter school accountability is kind of a joke, right? Not only do they have all the same accountability as every other public school, but now we have 55 pages of additional terrible things that are being sort of thrown onto charters and just charters in addition to all of the other stuff. So it's a horribly titled bill, and one that I think was put together specifically to mislead people who don't care to read all 55 pages of awful below the title.
Right. So that kind of brings us into the next question here, which is, you know, like you said, this bill is massive. It seems like a drastic effort to use a lack of better terms, almost seems like an attack on charter schools, if I may say. So, you know, in your opinion, why do you think this bill is being brought forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're being very diplomatic, which is good, but it is. It's a full frontal attack on charters. It's the worst piece of charter school legislation introduced in the history of Colorado. So in the 30 years that we've had the Charter Schools Act here, this is the most egregious assault on their autonomy and their existence as schools as we've ever seen. It's as bad as it gets. So, you know, as far as why it's being brought, typically, I mean, I've worked in policy for a long time, worked in politics for a long time, and I make a living off of trying to understand where the other side is coming from so that we can have reasonable debates and maybe come to an agreement. But every now and then you come across a bill that is just so overtly malicious and so obviously intended to do harm that you just can't, there's no room for those discussions, right? And so one of the things that we've told our Education Alliance of Colorado members is that even though we're very often looking to change bills or amend bills or find sort of compromise where we can all figure out a path forward together, with this bill, you can't do that. I mean, this bill was authored by people who clearly despise charters, who want to harm charters. And in the long run, when you really dig into the guts of the bill, would like to see charters close who are already open and not see new charters open anywhere in the state if they have their druthers. So, you know, at the risk of being overly simplistic about it, this thing is very much intended as a direct shot to the jaw of the charter school movement in the state. And it's tough to read it as anything other than an act of malice.
It's pretty surprising seeing a bill like this, considering that Colorado is known for its charter schools. They've been around for decades. I don't know the exact number, but I know thousands and thousands of students in Colorado use charter schools, and there's a lot of support for charter schools. And for full disclosure, I've said this before on the podcast, so I sit on the board of directors for a charter school in School District 20, and it's a great option for parents who maybe aren't happy with their district or any number of reasons. Maybe even it's location. Maybe it's closer than what their district school is, or if it's better in certain areas that their students need better help with. There's just a total number of reasons why parents choose charter schools. And so they're very popular here. And even our own governor has started two charter schools himself. And so, you know, I don't know where the governor stands on this, but it'll be interesting to see if he comes out for it or against it, and how strongly either way, if when he does make a comment on this, which I'm sure he will if he hasn't already. So that's kind of big picture on this bill. Let's kind of get into some of the key provisions of this bill. Again, it's 55 pages. I encourage anyone to go to the Colorado General Assembly website, type in HB24-1363 under the bill search option, pull the bill up yourself. It will take you a while to get through it, but I went ahead and pulled out some of the key provisions in it. And so we'll cover those now, and I'll have you expand on some of those provisions. So we'll start with one of the first things mentioned in the bill is automatic waivers. A lot of the language that I'm going to be reading off of comes directly from the bill. And it says, this bill repeals the provision to allow automatic waivers by the State Board of Education for charter school contracts. So can you kind of explain to the audience the use and the importance of automatic waivers?
Yeah, so charter schools, like we mentioned, are public schools, right? But there are two things that make them different and unique. The first is that they have their own governing board. So they're not governed by a local school district board. They have their own governing board in a school that was authorized by the elected local school board in most cases, right? Or by the Charter School Institute in a few cases. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they are able to waive out of certain parts of state statute and school district policy. So sometimes people hear that and they think that charters have carte blanche to sort of waive out of anything they want. They don't, right? So they can't, for instance, waive out of the accountability requirements for public schools. They're not able to do that and say, we just don't want to participate. They can't waive out of financial management requirements in state statute and say, we just don't want to do that. But what they can do is waive laws and policies that deal with how they operate the school, right? And the idea for that is that charters are meant to be unique schools of choice. Nobody is zoned to attend a charter school. Everybody who is in a charter school chose to be there for one reason or another. And usually it's because the charter is offering an educational model that they can't find somewhere else. So in practice, what you see is these waivers coming through in a way that allows the charters to hire their own personnel from sometimes from licensed teachers, sometimes from people who have been professionals in certain fields for many, many years, sometimes from somewhere else entirely. So they can hire their own personnel. They decide how they're going to evaluate and pay those personnel without being subject to collective bargaining agreements, union contracts, step and lane systems in the school district. They decide what their curricula will be. So how do we want to teach math and reading and history, for instance, and which books do we want to use and which materials do we want to use? What are our graduation requirements? You know, how does it look for a kid to move from elementary school to middle school to high school and then graduate out and matriculate, we hope, to college or the military or wherever they happen to go? Right. So all of those sort of details of how their model operates are controlled primarily by these waivers. If you were to get rid of waivers for charters and or make it harder for them to get, which in this case, that's what the bill is doing, right? It's saying no more automatic waivers. Now you have to come and apply for each and every one, no matter how mundane they are. Two things will happen. Number one, you're going to gum up the state government horribly because the waiver process can be lengthy. And if you require them to come in and apply for every waiver that's granted automatically, just as a matter of form, because a lot of them are not all that important and are just accepted after 30 years, you're going to slow down the process a lot, which I think is part of the intent. But ultimately, if you make it really hard for them to get waivers, they're not going to be charters anymore, right? In the absence of those waivers and the ability to be flexible and autonomous schools, they're just public schools like any other. At which point you have negated the choices of hundreds of thousands of Colorado parents who selected those schools specifically because they're independent, specifically because they do things differently than other schools in the area might.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. I can just imagine how much resources and things from each charter school to have to dedicate personnel. I mean, they may even have to hire personnel just to work on doing these waivers every single year and applying. And then, like you said, it's going to gum up the system and the wait time is going to be forever when you have however many charter schools in the entire state all sending in waivers every single year at the same time. It sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. And like you mentioned, that may be the intent of the bill is
I think that's exactly what they want. It to be as painful and difficult as possible.
If we're just being honest. Okay, let's move on to facilities. So again, this is from the bill. Under current law, a charter school is not required to pay rent for school district facilities that are available. And an independent charter school is not required to pay more than $12 in rent per year for a building of public school that is subject to conversion. And then also in facilities, repeals the requirement that a school district provide a list of vacant and underused buildings and land to district charter schools and prohibits district charter schools from using those vacant facilities. That was a lot of words there. Can you kind of explain the importance of like keeping the current law and how the cost to charter schools will be affected? And if a lot of people don't know, basically charter schools, a big cost to charter schools, something like 20 to 30% of their budget goes into paying for facilities and things like that. And because they don't have the option of basically raising the funds through taxes, through, mill levies or bond levies and things like that to raise taxes. So if you can kind of expand on this facilities aspect.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, one of the biggest challenges for charters is where they're going to be, right? Where are they going to house the school physically? For two reasons. The first one is that they don't have access to district resources. So when a school district, let's take a school district that has 100,000 kids, right? It's probably pulling down a budget of $1 billion a year. Plus they have mill levy overrides that the voters have passed. Plus they have bond issues, as you mentioned. You know, when they go out and they buy a school, the individual school isn't paying for that. The school district is paying for it. So if they're building a new building, the school district is financing that. If they're purchasing a building, the school district is financing that. Charter schools are on their own, right? So if you're going to open a charter school, one of the questions that you're going to be asked during your application process is, where the heck are you going to put this thing? And they've got to go out and either find an existing building, which is hard, right? Anybody, especially in the Denver area, you drive around, there's not a lot of empty spots left, right?
Right.
Land is hard to come by. Buildings that could be used well as a school are hard to come by. And that's a challenge on their own. And then beyond that, they have to figure out a way to pay for it. Like you said, usually in the absence of any sort of help from the school district. So they have to go out and get their own bonds. They have to secure their own financing, sometimes from private sources to make that happen. And it's hard. There have been a lot of schools that have either failed to open or not been approved, or later failed after they opened because they couldn't afford their facilities. It is a huge, huge thing. And the bill really, without getting into the weeds of each individual provision, is designed to exacerbate the problem, right? So not only are we now saying you're responsible for all that stuff, oh, and we're probably going to carve you out of any district bond issue that we put in front of donors or in front of taxpayers, although I guess they probably feel like coerced donors most of the time. But, you know, not only are we going to carve you out of that, but we're also going to say that now we're not even going to tell you if we have open buildings, right? So you look at these school districts that are having massive school closures, right? They're closing dozens of schools. Those buildings don't get bulldozed. They just sit there, right?
Right.
And under code law, the charters have to be notified that they exist along with other folks, which is kind of mutually beneficial, right? There's an opportunity for purchase there. There's an opportunity for some type of deal to be made. Now we say, well, we don't need to tell them at all. So they've got to go out and basically start from scratch to find them. And then you have these various provisions that are designed to make sure that if there is a situation where a charter is going to be using a district facility in some way, shape, or form, the district has pretty broad latitude to determine how much they're going to charge the charter for that, right? And that can take a whole bunch of different forms. You know, once you remove the limitations on that, it could be that they start charging exorbitant levels specifically to keep the charter from using it, or it could be that they charge levels that are high enough that they start causing serious problems to the charter's instructional budget or whatever.
Right.
But the idea there is pretty simple, right? All of those provisions are very clearly designed to make the already most painful part of being a charter school even more acutely painful. And in the long run are designed to stop schools from opening. I mean, that is the bottom line, is that you're trying to prevent schools from finding adequate space to open a school. And if they can't find adequate space to open a school, then they don't open a school, which I believe is very much the sponsor's intent here.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. All right, moving on. Board makeup. So this is from the bill. At least 1/3 of a charter school board must be made up of parents or guardians of students attending the school, as well as reflect the community demographics. Can you kind of expand on this one? This is very interesting. Just from my take on it, reading it, it's a local control thing, you know, telling the state, telling individual charter schools, who they can and can't have run their charter schools. So that's kind of my take on it. I'd be curious to know, what your take on it is.
Yeah. So like we talked about, charters have their own independent boards, right? So they're authorized by a school board, but then they set up their own board that actually governs the school. They make decisions about, you know, who's going to be the executive director, who's going to be the principal, how do we want to handle our curricula. Those boards operate, they are public boards, they sit in public schools, they handle public dollars, right? So they're subject to open meetings laws and all sorts of other accountability pieces already, which is important because these are not boards that are just operating in the dark, right? It's not like it's three people sitting at a Denny's restaurant talking about what they want to do. These are actual public boards subject to state law. And so the idea that we need to get in there and meddle with them by dictating to charters what they should look like is wild. And something that we don't do with other boards, including notably with local school boards, right? So when your school board candidates go to run for office on those local school boards, nobody squints at them and says, well, this percentage of you has to be an active parent in the district and you have to be from this background. And also you kind of have to look like the demographics of the community. That just isn't the case, and it's never been the case for any of those boards. Applying that to charters doesn't make sense for a lot of reasons. First of all, being that there's not a lot of precedent for doing it. Second of all, being that the way the bill is drafted is sloppy enough that it's going to be detrimental, right? So charters very often hold, either they appoint their boards or they elect their own boards inside the charters where the parents themselves are voting on who they'd like to be in the board. But people are busy, right? And these boards have to function. So it's not like there are incredibly long lines of people banging down the doors to give up, you know, huge amounts of their time every month to sit on one of these boards and work on it. The people who do are amazing folks, and we should all be very happy for them and for having them on the team. But the idea that you are now going to make it even harder for charters to go out and recruit good quality people to be on your board is wild. On top of the fact that there are a lot of good reasons that maybe you want your board to look a little different, right? So like maybe right now at this season in your charter's journey, what you really want on your board are community members from local businesses, or maybe somebody who has a facilities background or a finance background. Maybe you need somebody who has a legal background and you want someone who can kind of round out that side of the team, or somebody who came from elected office and has a background in how to make a board work. There are a lot of reasons that you could want someone on those boards who is not a parent. Parents are often on them. That's great. I think most charters want parents on there already. We don't need state law to dictate that to them. And then beyond that, the bill says, well, it has to mirror the demographics of the community, but then very helpfully doesn't define for us what exactly the demographics of the community means. So, you know, taking that to the extreme, we can probably assume that we're talking about racial composition, right? So are we talking about some type of quota here where we have to match those percentages? But it doesn't mention if we're talking about, for instance, folks with disabilities or maybe short people or maybe people from other places or people that live in certain types of neighborhood. I mean, there's no definition applied to what demographics mean. So in practice, it will be impossible for charters to actually comply with this requirement. And even if we could suss out what this means, it doesn't necessarily matter, right? So charters are schools of choice. As we said earlier, nobody is zoned to attend a charter school.
Right.
Everybody chooses to be there. And very often they choose to be there by driving from a really long way away to get there. And so the community that any given charter school serves may or may not look directly like the community where the school is physically located, right? They have to go find a facility, which is tough. They find one. Maybe it's in this spot, maybe it's in this spot, but they find a facility. And then you have people coming from far and wide to the school. And so really a charter board ought to look like the charter school's community, right? That's the group of people they're serving. Whether or not it exactly mirrors the wider community around them is sort of an irrelevant question. And to me, sort of betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of what a school of choice is, right? It treats it as if
it's a
neighborhood school where people are zoned, and it isn't, right? And we shouldn't expect it to look that way. If we do expect it to look that way, we're going to get bad results. That's not what charters do. Charters know how to do this. They've been doing it for 30 years. They have really strong boards. They're producing amazing results. They don't need the state legislature to tell them how to run a board. And I would respectfully submit that if the legislature were interested in putting together requirements for more competent bodies, they might start with themselves or maybe with local school boards, because they could use some help on their end before they start coming out to the schools and dictating the requirements to them.
Those are great points. And just from my personal experience of sitting on a charter school board, kind of to add on the 2 points that you made, yes, it is very hard to find people to volunteer their time and money and resources to attend these meetings. I mean, sometimes we have 2 meetings a month. You know, you have a regular board meeting, and then you have a work session. And for us, they're every Wednesday, and they're almost always about 2 hours long. It takes a lot of time. And then you have different responsibilities on the board, whether you're a treasurer, or you're the president or vice president or vice chair. And so there's a lot of time and effort that goes into being on a school board. And whenever we put out an opening for people to put in applications, sometimes you get a handful, sometimes you get one or two. And so the idea that you would make it, you would put all these requirements on there and make it even harder, that's worrisome to me from the position that I sit on. And not only that, like you had mentioned, sometimes we look for specific people with specific talents. Like, hey, it's really nice because we're dealing with the public's money. It's really nice to maybe have somebody with a financial background to sit on this board as well to help us go through and look at, you know, our financial statements and get another set of eyes on there. Or for instance, one time we were adding on to our school building a gym facility, and we were like, hey, you know what? It would be nice to have somebody with a construction background because this is going to be a couple year process, and they speak the language and they can help, you know, facilitate this between us and the construction company and things like that. So you really do look for different qualities in people, and the idea that all of a sudden you would start basing this on demographics, like such as race, or like you said, any other, I mean, what about ideological demographics or something? Is that what they're talking about? Who knows? Because just saying demographics is very vague. So making it harder is,
as far as I know, and this could be wrong. So, but as far as I know in the education universe, this is the first time that the state government has attempted to dictate anything that looks like a demographic requirement onto a public body, right?
Right.
We don't do this for legislative office. We don't tell you that you have to be from a certain background or look a certain way or believe certain things to run for office. We don't do it with local school boards. We don't do it with county commissions. We don't do it with city councils. We don't do it with town councils. We don't even do this with water boards or liquor boards or boards that you've never even heard of. And the idea that now we're going to get into the business of the state government dictating to you, oh, let's say you have a scenario, like you said, you've got an open spot, you put it out there, you get three applicants, and you have to go back to each of those three applicants and say, hey, listen, we can't let you do that because we really need someone who is like this.
Right.
That is not only wrong, but it is like 17 lawsuits waiting to happen. It's a horrible idea. And they
my initial thought was this seems very discriminatory against people.
Purpose, right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Excellent. I really appreciate that. It was a great explanation. We have just a couple more things here. So it says repeals the ability of charter school applicants to seek a second decision from the state board when a local board rejects a charter school application a second time. Okay. That was a lot of words there. Can you kind of dive into what that means?
Yeah. So, if you are a charter school in Colorado, you are a sheep in a field full of wolves is the way that it works for you, right? So in order to exist, you have to be authorized by either a local school district or the state charter school institute, right? Those are your only two options. There is no other way to become a charter school, period, the end.
Right.
Which means that if you are, and beyond that, most school districts have something called exclusive chartering authority, which means that even if they were to say, hey, we don't like you and you can't open a charter here and reject your application, and you say, okay, well, I'd like to go apply with the state, with the Charter School Institute. They have to actually vote to release you to go and apply with the Charter School Institute before you can even do that. And they can just say no, right? So back that up and realize that local school boards here are basically voting to authorize schools that are going to compete with their schools for students, and then by extension for the dollars associated with those students, right? So you're asking them to authorize their own competition. And then you're giving them basically unlimited authority to decide that they don't want to do that, right?
Right.
So that's what it's like to be a charter school who's trying to get open. The only recourse that they have in state law is to go to the Colorado State Board of Education. It's a nine-person board. It's currently six Democrats and three Republicans. And say, we were treated unfairly, and the decision of the local school board was against the best interests of students and the community, right? The state board reviews the decision of the local board, and they may say, hey, you got this wrong and you need to review it. They send it back to the local school board. This is the current process. The local school board at that point can agree and say, yeah, we got it wrong. Let's do it right this time and approve the charter. Or they can say, pound sand, we don't want to, and we're still not going to open the school. If that happens currently, charter schools can then take it back to the state board for a second appeal and say, look, this is still going on. They're still behaving outside the bounds of the law. And the state board then has the authority to issue a final order to the school district that has to be complied with on that second appeal, right? Almost, I won't say almost no, but it's rare for charters to get the second appeal. Usually it gets resolved on the first appeal, but there are instances where it does have to go to that second slot. The bill would get rid of the second ruling entirely, which would mean that the only option the charters have is to appeal once, and then get a non-binding ruling from the state board. So the state board says, hey, listen, you're behaving poorly, school district. You should approve this school. It's a strong applicant. Here are the reasons for that. And the bill very explicitly says that the school board can look at that and say, nope, we still don't like it and we still don't want to do it. And then the charter's out of luck. They have nowhere else to go. And I think it's really important for people to understand under this bill, that's the end of the line.
Yeah.
The school district says no, the state board can't reverse them, and the district won't release them to CSI. That's it. You could have the strongest school model in the world put together the perfect application.
Right.
And you have no recourse at that point. It's over for you.
Yeah.
And importantly, it's not just for new schools. It's also for schools that are coming up for renewal. So let's say you're an existing school, you come to the end of your 3-year contract or whatever you have, and you have to go back up for renewal. The school district can do this to you too. Maybe you have 1,000 kids and they just decide, I don't want to do this anymore, and you can't be open. You are now legally entirely helpless to stop that in any way, shape, or form. I mean, that is a shocking provision that removes the only lifeline in an already difficult situation that these schools have. And it's horrifying, to be honest with you. And it should send kind of shivers down the spine of anybody who is involved in the charter movement, whether it's an existing school or a new school, because if this passes, you're on your own. No recourse, nowhere to go.
Yeah. Like you said, some of these charter schools, you know, our charter school has over 600 students to it, and it's a great community. And the idea that you were put in place a process that could put us out of business, for lack of better terms, is frightening, because I mean, where are all those students going to go, and how negatively are they going to be affected? A lot of them, most of them start at kindergarten, and we have through eighth grade, and we have kids there that are in fifth and sixth grade who've been going there the entire time. Last thing from this bill, go ahead.
And it's worth noting that there are other pieces of it that sort of tie back into this, right? So not only are you cutting off the appeal process, but then they write in language saying, well, currently you can't deny charters for reasons that are just sort of capricious, right? You can't just decide that you hate them and not take
them. You just don't like them, right?
This one says that, among other reasons, one reason that you could deny a charter application would be because your school district is experiencing declining enrollment. It doesn't have any stipulate. What if the district and the charter school are experiencing declining enrollment? We see this very often, but they could still decide, because the district is experiencing declining enrollment, that they could shut you down. And importantly, 7 out of the 10 biggest districts in the state, so these are the districts that serve the bulk of Colorado's public school students, are experiencing declining enrollment, right? And then you have dozens of schools all over, or school districts all over the state, that are also experiencing declining enrollment and have been since COVID, right?
Right.
The state is actually handing out money to these districts because they're losing kids so quickly that they can't make their budgets work.
Yeah.
So you're effectively talking about everybody, right?
Right.
At this stage, with only a handful of really notable exceptions, declining enrollment is the norm, not the exception. Right. And you've now made that alone a reason to be able to deny a charter application and then cut off the appeal process. And it's really hard to read that in any way other than to believe that the intent here is to produce fewer charter schools, right? Fewer new schools, fewer renewals. You would not write something like that into a bill unless you wanted charters to go away. And at the risk of sounding too incendiary, that's what the bill is designed to do. It is designed to end the charter movement in the state. And that's not an exaggeration. It's not a political messaging point. That is what it does. And it's what it will do if it passes.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. That's why when I saw the title that said accountability, I said, oh boy. Usually when you hear accountability in a bill from the legislature, you better strap in, because you're going to be in for a ride, because it's usually a little bit more than just accountability, which is a nice word that most people agree with, right? Last thing from the bill, it allows a single community member to appeal the decision of a school board on a charter school application. When I read this, I thought I read it wrong, and then I thought I was understanding it wrong. But can you elaborate on this single community member to appeal the decision of a school board?
Yeah, so you didn't read it wrong, unfortunately, for all of us. Not only does the bill cut off recourse for charters who are denied an application, it now opens up a new vein for anybody within the geographic boundaries of a district. Keep in mind, these are vast entities, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about Denver Public Schools, Jefferson County. I mean, millions of people live in
right.
them, right? These right. are really big areas.
Yeah.
And you're saying that any one of those people who doesn't like a charter school, and there are always people who don't like right. the charter schools opening or schools being renewed, can come right. back and appeal the approval of a charter. So put yourself in the shoes of a charter school founder, for instance. Mm. You're a new school. You fill out the application. It's 460 pages long. You get the funding. You somehow, through some miracle, secure a facility. You get through the local school board. They approve your school, and you're ready to go for next school year. And then some guy you've never heard of who, like, lives in a one-bedroom apartment somewhere right. on the east end of town shows up and says, well, I don't like this.
Yeah, he doesn't even have kids or a vested interest in it, right?
Kids going to school, or he just doesn't like you. Maybe he just doesn't right. like somebody who's involved in the charter. Maybe it's a personal right. thing. Yeah. And he shows up and says, I don't like this. So he can now actually appeal the approval of the charter application to the state board. And the state board then can overturn the approval of the school by the local school district. Mm-hmm. And notably, can do that without all this stuff saying that it's not binding on the denial side. So in the case of a denial, the state board can say you shouldn't have done that and wag a finger, but it's not binding. It doesn't say that for these appeals. So it can go in there. These guys could appeal it. The state board says, yeah, we kind of don't like it either. And they actually can flip that decision back over for the local school district, at which point you have caused incredible amounts of disarray, right? The amount of work right. that goes into approving one of these schools is huge. Anybody who's ever been involved on the authorizing side knows that. And now we're going to undo the decision of an elected board because a random person who has nothing to do with any of this stuff right. decided that he or she doesn't like it. That is a wild inclusion. And to be honest with you, this is why we have elections, right? We live in a democracy. If you live in a community where most people don't want charter schools, they're probably going to elect a local school board who doesn't want to authorize charter schools, right? That is their opportunity to make their voices heard the same way as it is everywhere else in representative government in America. The idea that we're now going to subvert that is incredible. And again, as far as I know, completely unprecedented in the realm of government generally, but especially in the realm of K-12 education. I don't know of anything that even remotely looks like that anywhere else in state law. It's a crazy provision. I'm shocked that it made it into the final bill.
I've never heard anything like this either. It like you said, dude, apply it to something else. Hey, if a state law is going through committee and one person in the entire state doesn't like it, and then they can file an appeal to it, you know, they would never put themselves in that position, but it seems like they're totally okay with putting charter schools in that position.
But not a legal challenge, right? That's important. Because if I don't like a state law, I could mount a legal challenge to it.
That's fair.
Right? I can go to the court and say, hey, look, I think this is wrong constitutionally or whatever and work my way through the court system. But that's not what this does. This just gives it over to the State Board of Education and lets them make the decision. No courts, no judges, no law. It's just an opinion thing. That's not how we ought to govern. We live in a state with like a million public school students.
Right.
This isn't how you handle that. Not if you're a responsible adult.
Absolutely. Ross, we have one more question for you. And again, we really appreciate your time here and doing this on short notice. So final question, how can people get involved to help charter schools protect school choice, that whole movement? What's your take on that and opinion on how people can get involved?
Yeah, so the most immediate need is for folks to reach out to members of the House Education Committee. For anybody who doesn't watch the legislative process closely, every bill that gets introduced has to get a committee hearing. Colorado is somewhat unique among states in that regard. Sometimes bills just don't get hearings. In Colorado, they have to.
Right.
So it's going to come up before that committee. It will be voted on by that committee. The committee is a 7-4 committee, 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans currently. And if it gets through that vote, it will go out to the full chamber. If it gets through that, it goes over to the Senate and we restart the committee process. And then ultimately would go to Governor Polis. And as you said early on, Jarvis, there are a lot of reasons to believe that the governor would not be in support of this. However, it is worth noting that the bill getting out of committee at all is a dangerous message, right? The idea right. that a piece of legislation that is this harmful to this many hundreds of thousands of kids could advance out of even the first step of the legislative process is really scary. And the idea that it would make it all the way to the governor is even scarier. And so it's important for these committee members to hear pretty much right now from everybody they can that this thing has to stop on the very first hopscotch square. Like, it can't go any further than that. And there are a couple ways to do that. You can go and look up the committee members on the General Assembly's website and send them a note. You can also look up their phone numbers, their official phone numbers, and give them a call. If you are interested, there are a few petitions and campaigns floating around out there, including one from the Education Alliance of Colorado that makes it easier for you to do that. You can just write a message and send it off, and I will give you the link in case you want to include that in the podcast notes or whatever else. But really getting in touch with them and letting them know that this is going to be devastating to the schools that mean so much to your kids and to your families, that's what you need to be doing right now in the short term. In the long term, this is sort of a wake-up call, I think, or should be a wake-up call for everybody in Colorado, that even after 30 years, even with them representing something in the neighborhood of 15% of all the public school enrollment in the state, charters aren't safe, right? This isn't a done deal. It's not a thing that lasts forever, and it can be taken away if we're getting complacent on it. And so that should be a message to folks that, look, when a charter school puts out a note saying we need somebody for the board, it shouldn't just be two people applying for that. You should have 100 people applying for that because they want to be involved in it. Or maybe they want to run for their local school board, or maybe they want to show up and testify at a state board charter appeal, or maybe they want to get involved legislatively. But I worry that the charter movement has been so successful that we are beginning to get a little complacent and believe that, you know, we're good and nobody could possibly pull the rug out from underneath us. But they can. And not only that, but this bill seems to demonstrate a desire to do exactly that. So it's time to stop sleeping and get busy if you're a charter supporter, for sure.
Hey, that's great advice. That's a great place to leave off here. You know, we are called Engage the Rockies. And so that's what we're sitting here advocating for, is people to get engaged in their communities and their local government and, you know, be a part of the process. Because like you said, if you get complacent, then kind of these things that you're used to might start going away and you don't even realize it till it's too late. There's a pretty good quote that's it. If you don't take an interest in the government, it'll take an interest in you. Or I don't remember who said that, but basically, if you're not paying attention to it, well, you know, things are still going to be happening.
And here's another one. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu, right? So
I like
remember that it's sometimes cool and in vogue to cover your eyes and say, I don't do politics, I don't pay attention to that stuff. But other people do politics and they write bills like this. And even if you don't show up, this stuff still happens. So opting out is not an option, not if you want to protect the things that we've got here in the state.
That's awesome advice. And I'm going to write that down. I appreciate that. So Ross, thank you again. It is for the audience listening. It is a Friday evening and this was very short notice. And Ross was so generous with his time to jump in here and do this on short notice like that. So we really appreciate it, Ross. And thank you for everything that you do on behalf of the students and the parents of Colorado and school choice and charter schools and everything like that. If you're listening to this right now and you appreciate it, please like, subscribe, share it. This is very important. If I remember correctly, I looked to see if the bill was actually scheduled yet for the education committee. It's assigned to education. I don't believe it actually has a date and time yet. So I'd recommend to the audience to keep an eye on that. You can look it up on the General Assembly website and see when it's actually going to be scheduled. And, you know, if you're passionate about this or interested, or you just, you know, care about the future of charter schools in Colorado, be sure to sign up, submit written testimony, anything like that, support groups, such as, that Ross is associated with. So again, we appreciate it very much, Ross. And until next time, we'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.